Okay, so let's get started. There is a project that I have put up on the course webpage. I'm going to discuss that in the class today. It's going to be due 2 weeks from today. Okay, so that's first announcement. The other thing I'm going to do before I actually start talking about communication and message oriented and stream oriented communication is go back to some stuff I had wanted to show a few classes back. So when we are talking about virtualization, I had mentioned that I will show a few demos just to give you a flavor of how these technologies work. So I'm going to do that today. And on Thursday, I'll give a short demo of RPCs and RMIs and how to write code and whatnot. Okay. So let's start with that. Then we can come back to the class. So we talked about several types of virtualization, desktop virtualization, server virtualization, OS virtualization, and I'm going to show three examples. Okay. First one is desktop virtualization. So what happens in this case is you have a virtualization piece of software, which is the virtualization layer, that is running on your desktop. Your desktop is running your some operating system, okay, Windows, Linux, Mac, OS X. And this virtualization layer actually runs on top, and then it allows you to create virtual machine and run other operating systems in those containers that it has created. Okay. So here is an example of the VMware desktop virtualization. Okay, so this is it's an application that's running here. You can create new virtual machine. So I'll show you an example. So here is one that you can create. Okay, typically when you create it, you can actually have an installed disk for your OS image, and it will actually copy that disk into that virtual container. But you can also create one without. So here is a custom virtual machine. So you can pick your OS. It supports several. So I just picked Solaris for as an example. And then you can pick the flavor of. And then you basically take Solaris 10 and you'd say continue, and it'll create a virtual disk. And then you can take a Solaris install CD or DVD or package and then install it on there. So here is, so that's how you create one. So I'm going to actually show you not create one because installing will take time. So here is one that I have already installed. This is FreeBSD. Okay, it's currently, just a second. So it is actually suspended right now. So it's starting up. So it's ready. So here is the virtual machine console. Okay, so this just looks like basically one OS running on top of another. It has its own processes. So here are all the processes that are running on there. Okay. Now all of this is only visible to the virtual machine. Okay. The underlying OS doesn't actually see any of these processes because this is running in a virtual container. So just to show you, here are the processes that are visible to the Mac itself. Right, so, okay, so all it is actually seeing is this VMware Fusion application. It doesn't actually see the OS that's running in there or any of those processes. Okay, so that's it. And that's only seen by the virtual machine itself. You know, you can take snapshots, which is basically a copy of the file state, disk state. You can roll back, so you can do all of this. Yeah, so if you corrupt your image, you can actually roll back because it's all virtual disks. You can create copies and you can hand that copy to someone. They can boot that virtual machine and whatnot. Okay. So you can then suspend it, in which case it starts saving again. Okay, so now it's stopped. So just to give you a flavor of all the virtual machines, so you don't even have to install an image. You can actually get prepackaged images. They are called appliances. So if you go to, for instance, if you want to look at VMware appliances, you go there and you click on this virtual appliances, you will see hundreds of appliances that are out there. Okay, so let's just look for, so if you want to download an appliance which is a prepackaged Linux virtual machine, you could just search for it. And there are several, as you can see, that have applications and OS packages bundled. So these are business applications here. So here are several. So you can get various distributions. This is Mandriva Linux. You can get SUSE Linux, Red Hat Linux, Ubuntu, whatever you want. Somebody has created a package. So I actually downloaded the free BSD as an appliance. I actually install it myself. So you can get this and it just downloads. So I'll show you what it is going to look like. So this is what you get, a zip file. Okay, that's your appliance. You unzip it and here are all the files. So this is the virtual disk for that BSD OS I was showing you. These are just files on your local machine, but for the virtual machine that represents a disk with a root partition and a user partition and whatnot. You can split it into multiple individual disks, or you can have one of your own as the virtual machine itself. Okay. And these are all log files that are created when it boots up. Okay. That's the state that the virtual machine layer actually keeps on disk. So that's how you can resume, because it has kept a copy of the disk, the memory state, as a file on disk. So when you restart it, it actually loads that back in RAM and it looks like you never stopped the read. So things like this are done in this context. So that is desktop virtualization. Okay, so if you remember in the discussion, we talked about type 1 and type 2 virtualization as well. And there you have a virtual machine that runs on bare metal. Okay, here the virtual machine is running on another OS. So you can just implement the virtualization layer and create containers. Okay, so there are several examples of that. So here's a machine that has the Xen hypervisor running on it. Okay, so this is basically the hypervisor layer that allows you to create multiple machines in there. So let's look what is on there. Okay, so right now there is nothing other than the hypervisor, which is referred to as domain 0. Okay, so you can create a new virtual machine. A file, something file you have to specify. So this will create a new virtual machine for you using the parameters specified in that file. So now this thing is booting, as you can see. So it has started, though it's not started, it is starting that new virtual machine that we have just created. So now you have a Ubuntu virtual machine that just got created on that machine. You can log into it. So this just like in the desktop case, this just looks like its own VM. So it has its own processes, own file system. Same concept, except that all of the stuff is handled by the hypervisor, which is running on bare metal, not on another OS. Okay, so now you can see this. So you can go back to the hypervisor, which is here. And now if you see, go back to the list, you'll see that a second virtual machine has been created. That's the hypervisor. It created another one. So now there are two running, the hypervisor itself and a test. So you can create as many as you want. Each is a container of its own. It has its own OS. It's running its own processes and applications. Okay, you have a question there?
How does it appear to the OS? We started this from the OS. How does this appear? Is it like previous case where it's using only a process?
Well, in this case, there is no OS. The only OS you have is what is the hypervisor.
But then this was started on.
Yeah, so this I'm logged into the hypervisor here. So it looks like an OS, but it's really at the hypervisor layer. Right, so is that clear what I just said?
For this OS, right? For this laptop.
So this is actually, I have remote. No, this is not running here. I've logged into a different machine. This is SSH console. This is a machine somewhere else. So it's not running, nothing is running here. Okay, so this machine is running a hypervisor. I just logged in there. That's the name of the machine. Okay. Any questions here?
How do you return to the hypervisor? Does it have a catch or like a key command?
Yeah, so each one has its own. So here it's control square bracket. It basically escapes. It just goes from one console to another. So there's a console for this, the console for the hypervisor. I was in the console for the virtual machine.
So does it do anything else that like the operating system has no knowledge of? That's the virtual operating system?
So there is no OS here. I mean, there's a hypervisor.
What about the test? Like the test.
For the test.
There are like key shortcuts and certain things you can do that return you to the hypervisor.
Right. So that's not known to the OS because I'm logged into this this machine. That is what is catching my keystroke and returning me back. The OS there is not doing anything. The hypervisor itself that allowed me to switch back and forth. Okay. Is this clear? Okay, so the last thing, so these are two forms also. The other thing I mentioned is this is para-virtualized. This is basically a special version of Linux that was booted, which was modified so that it could make calls directly to the hypervisor instead of taking a trap when it executes sensitive instructions and so on that we discussed. Okay, so just as an example of what a para-virtualized one looks like. The last one is OS level virtualization. This is not hardware virtualization. So here is just a normal Linux box. Okay, I'm logged in as root here. And you can just see that this is basically a normal Linux machine. And what you can do in this on this machine is create basically a OS level container. Okay, it is not going to run another OS in that container. It's the same OS. All that this OS is doing is provide restricted access from within this container. So I'll explain what that means. Let's just guest. So here is a container that I had already created called guest, which is now currently not running. So we can start it. Okay. Now it has started. Okay, so now when you do status, you can show that it's running, shows the number of processes in that container, it shows the uptime and whatnot. Okay, so now you can enter this container. Okay, so now I am actually inside this container. So what this is basically doing is you take this OS, it has, let's say, a bunch of processes and there's a disk with files. When you create an OS level container, all you are doing is you are creating a subset of the resources. So you take some processes, take some files, and these processes now cannot see the other processes on the system. They can only see each other. Okay? So the OS is creating what is called a jail or a container, which just prevents this subset of resources on the machine, these files and these processes from seeing one another. Okay? So it looks like this is running its own virtual machine. It's not really a virtual machine. It's just a OS level restriction that prevents certain things from being visible. So if you see, it's the same machine. I haven't actually created anything. But the only thing, so you see that within this virtual machine, there are only these processes that are visible. They are the same processes as that machine. So their PIDs are the same, except that now these processes cannot see the processes on the full machine. So the OS has just put some restrictions which prevent it from doing this. You can also create a root file system within the main disk which just says this container can only see this part of the file system tree, for instance. Okay, so then those that subtree is not going to be able to see the full file system. It only restricts the part of the disk or the file system you can see from this container. Okay, this is called OS level virtualization. Also from the main console, you can assign resources to this container. You can say that it cannot get more than 10% of the CPU, cannot get more than 256 MB RAM, and anything that is running within that container will be only given those many resources and not more. Okay. So this is what an OS level virtualization does for you. Okay, you have a question? Yes. There's only one kernel. That's the kernel that we actually saw. So if I exit this, so I go back here. So unlike the previous case where the container was running its own OS and applications, here there's only one OS. This OS just says that I'm going to create this box, and what is in the box, it's a sandbox, cannot see what's outside. So the OS continues to manage those processes. Okay. So you can see that those are the same processes that are actually created at the original OS, but they are now restricted in this context.
But then you see that it has init. So is init
Yes, it's the same init, because you need a init as a, so let's do ps minus a. So you'll see some of these processes are there. So it's the same, yes, it is the same. Because there's only one kernel, so that's the init process. Is this clear? Any questions on this? Just a quick flavor of how virtualization, what virtualization platforms look like. Okay, so let's just stop with that. Yeah.
Suppose like one possible use of
No, so the what is running on the, when you create a new container, it gets its own process, sort of subset of the processes, and you have to start new processes in there. Someone, some of the original ones are inherited, like the init process and whatnot, but you cannot see the other ones, so they stay with the OS itself. Within the container, you can create new ones. Those new ones cannot see the other ones. That's the only restriction. You don't actually take some subset and then assign it to the container. That's not what happens. Okay? Yes.
Can the container have its own like OS settings that are different from the outside OS?
Yes.
Can they like change like appearance or change like?
Yeah. So there's a question about what's visible inside the OS container. So you can actually, there's a very fine grain set of settings which allow you to tell what can be done and what cannot be done. So you can say things like, if you are root, you can only do certain things in the container, but not other things. You can see certain things in a certain way, right? So you can say you cannot change the IP address of the machine, because it's the same machine. So if you want to restrict what the users in the containers can do, there are lots of settings you can turn on or off, depending on what level of trust you have.
Even if they're like a root in the container?
Even if they're in the root in the container, you can actually prevent them from doing certain things. Okay, so that is a quick overview of virtualization, and let me also describe the project before I move on to the class lecture for the day. So I already put this assignment up on the course web page. It's due in about 2 weeks. Okay. As I mentioned in the write-up, you can work in groups. Okay. Although this is actually a simpler assignment, it's probably a good idea to form your group now and work in groups, because subsequent assignments will involve more work. Okay. So it's a good way to get started. So the basic assignment is to get familiarity with remote procedure calls, threads, synchronization, and just writing a very simple distributed client-server application. So there's a client and a server. The server part of the application is going to be using a multi-tier architecture that we have been talking about. Okay. The specific application you have to write is a micro-blogging site. Okay, something like Twitter, but a very simplified version of it. Okay. There are two components on the server end, a front end and a back end. Okay, the back end is a database server. It's not a real database, which we'll just call it a database, but that's the component that interacts with the state that you'll keep on disk. Okay. The front end server is the one that is going to interact with clients or client processes. Okay. So the basic idea is the ability to post short text comments on a topic. Okay, just as you would do in any microblogging site, the ability to subscribe to certain topics and retrieve all posts that have been posted for that topic. That those are sort of the three or four calls that the front end server has to support. So you could say things like, post 677 and then a comment saying project is out, something like this. So you can do this post, it will go to the front end server, okay, and then that will basically store it in the database. Okay, it will pass it on to the database and it will get stored. users can also, users or client processes can also follow topics. Okay, so you can say follow and specify a topic 677. This subscribes you to all posts that are being made on that topic. Okay, can also unsubscribe from a topic. Okay.
So is that like sending an email when a new post is made, or how, what does that do?
No, follow just says that it's exactly what you do on Twitter. When you go and follow someone, you can start accessing their feeds. Right. So when you say follow, you're basically, this is like a publish subscribe model. There are topics of interest and people are basically posting to different topics. Okay, this topic, foo, bar, and so on. So there are a number of posts. You may not be interested in everything being posted. So this is like almost like a bulletin board with short messages, right? So you are saying I'm only interested in certain topics and you explicitly subscribe in order to start receiving posts on that topic. Okay, so you can follow and then you can retrieve. Okay, so you basically say retrieve and you just specify your username and you can optionally specify a timestamp. So what this does is the system keeps track of what you are subscribed to. So when you retrieve and you specify your username, so there is no real authentication, you just specify your username and it looks at your subscriptions and it sends you all the posts that have been posted on all subscribed topics since that timestamp. Is that clear? What the interface looks like? It's a very simple interface.
What does that say? Bar one?
This says retrieve. So retrieve.
Parentheses?
Oh, it's all specified. So it's a username and a timestamp. Yeah, so you basically look at the subscription and retrieve everything you have subscribed to, say that has been posted since the timestamp. The database server is, so the things you have to do here are, this needs to be multi-threaded. So multiple client processes can post query all at the same time. Okay? That's the interesting part here. The database server is where all of these posts are being stored. Okay? We'll assume that your database is a simple text file. Okay? That just logs everything that has come in, and when a retrieve command comes in, you need to go and query that database server for the topics that the user has subscribed to and retrieve all posts since that timestamp. Okay. So it's basically just, as I mentioned, your text file is going to have number of entries. The entries would be the username, the topic. You could create a file for each topic. That's really up to you how you create this database. And there's a comment that has been posted. There's a timestamp as well. Okay. So there's one line for each entry in the simplest case. And when you do retrieve, you can search by topic and get all the comments that were posted since a specified timestamp. Okay, you have a question? Yes.
Can we use an actual database?
Can we use an actual database? No, you have to write something simple. Okay, don't use an actual database here. Okay. So the only interesting thing here is if there are concurrent, again, the database server needs to be concurrent, meaning it can service multiple query and update requests at the same time. So when you are doing an update, you need to synchronize, okay, because you are modifying the text file. So you need to implement some form of locking or some form of synchronization to prevent query messages from being processed when there is an update taking place in the system. Okay. So very simple mutual exclusion, simple threading, and inter-process communication. You can use RPCs, you can use RMIs, you can use vanilla sockets. All that is really up to you. Okay. But these are distinct processes. Okay. And there could be any number of clients that are talking to the front-end server. That's what you need to ensure is implemented. Okay. Simple error handling has to be implemented as well. Okay. For instance, there's a restriction that text messages that you post cannot be longer than 50 characters. Okay? So if you send a message that's longer than that, you return an error. Okay? When you send a timestamp, you can't send negative timestamps or things like that. So you need to make sure that simple error handling is taken care of. Your system shouldn't crash if you just send some garbage as parameters. Okay? Yes, push. I'm sorry? I didn't
know.
Yes, there's no GUI or anything here that you need to implement. You can just write very simple command line programs that do this. Okay. But the goal is to really understand RPCs, thread synchronization, not to write GUIs for this. Alright, so that's the basic project description. If you have questions, come and talk to me. There's a more detailed description on the course page, okay, that I've put up. Okay, so now let's go back to our discussion and continue where we left off. So just a quick recap. So we talked about remote procedure calls, we talked about remote method invocation, which are RPCs in the context of object-oriented world, and we also talked about this lightweight RPCs, okay, which is an optimization. The client and the server are running on the same machine. So what we are going to do today is talk about message-oriented communication, and if time permits, I will talk about stream-oriented communication. Okay, so we started talking about, if you remember the end of last class, we were talking about sockets. Okay. So I presented some material out of order just to provide the right background for the course project. So we'll come back to that discussion in the context of message-oriented communication. But we'll start with some concepts. Yeah, so persistence and synchronicity. So this is the picture to keep in mind. Okay, so you have a client process and a server process, or a sender and a receiver, that want to communicate with one another. Okay, so here's the application at one end and the application at the other. There's an OS, and the application sends data over that goes over a network. So these could be intermediate hops. That the message traverses to and it appears at the other end. Okay. These, as you will see, are not necessarily network or IP routers. Okay. They could be message routers, as we will see, application level message routers. Okay. But at each hop, there is a routing program that decides how to forward the message to the next hop. Okay. In the simplest case, as I said, these just could be your standard network routers that are just routing TCP or UDP messages. But that need not be the case. There could be application level routers as well. Okay. So with that in mind, there's a question of what assumptions do we make about the application, okay, at the two endpoints when communication is taking place. Okay. So there are two dimensions to consider, the persistence dimension and the synchronicity dimension. Okay. So the simplest form of communication is what would be called persistent communication. Okay. So what happens in this case is the message, as it's routed through this multi-hop network, is stored at each hop until the next hop is ready, and then it's handed to the next hop. Okay. So this is basically a store and forward paradigm. Okay. Simple examples are email, or the way mail, postal mail works. Okay. So here is basically how mail was delivered in the old days using Pony Express. Okay. So a post office mail appears here. Okay. And you hand it over to this delivery person, who takes it to the next hop. Okay, and there the mail is sorted again, and mail that sort of goes off in this direction is sent on this pony, and the mail that needs to go to the other post office is sent. So it goes hop by hop until each piece of mail reaches its destination. Okay. So in each case, the mail is actually held until the next, it traverses to the next hop. Same is true in email. Okay, so email, you have basically sort of programs like send mail that will queue up your messages until the next hop is ready. Okay, if the mail server at the next hop is not running or is not ready for any reason, mail is held. It is not discarded immediately. There is a timeout, but it is held until the next hop is ready. So this is called store and forward paradigm for sending messages. Okay, this is not how TCP/IP works, as we will see in a moment. So the other side of the spectrum is what's called transient communication. Okay. Here, both the sender and the receiver applications have to be executing for communication to take place. Okay. Messages are not buffered anywhere in the system. Okay. When they are sent from one end, they basically traverse through the network, they appear at the other end. Okay. If any node along the path is not functioning, okay, or the application is not running, then message is discarded. This is why it's called transient as opposed to persistent communication. Messages don't persist in the network if the application endpoints or intermediate hops are not running. Okay. So you'll discard the message if it cannot be delivered to the next hop, next server, or the receiver. So transport level communication, basically TCP/IP, works in this fashion. Okay. itself. The router cannot contact the next hop router, it'll just discard the message. The application process crashes for any reason and a message arrives on a socket, the socket is, buffer is basically discarded by the OS. Okay? Unlike in email, which is very different. So if you are not logged in checking your mail, your messages are held for you by the system. That's a persistent queue of messages. So next time you log in using your client pulls all the messages that have arrived since you logged in last. Okay? So two different forms of communication, one persistent, one not. So the other dimension is the synchronicity dimension. So here you could either have asynchronous communication or synchronous communication. So this is basically the question of whether the sender is blocking after it has sent the message or not. The previous case, you are asking the question, are the sender and the receiver running at the same time? Are they executing? Here you just ask, when you send, do you block or do you continue? Okay. So if you have asynchronous communication, sending continues immediately after you have submitted the message. Okay. So you are not waiting for the message to go out, you are not waiting for the message to reach the other end or waiting for the message delivery to even take place. You just send and you continue. Okay. So all you need is a local buffer at the sending host. If you do synchronous communication, then you will block until the message has actually reached the other end or has basically been delivered at the other end. Okay? There are many variants of what blocking means, as we will see in just a moment. Okay? So now if you come back to the email example, you will see that that's asynchronous communication. Okay? I send an email and I don't wait until it has either reached or some of the other party I have sent was actually read the message, meaning it has delivered. So you just send and you continue. So then something else happens in the background. Okay? Synchronous communication is like chat. Okay, you are waiting. Basically, both parties are online at the same time. They are sending messages. Okay, messages are delivered immediately. Okay, so that's form of synchronous communication. So now we'll see several combinations of persistence and synchronous. These are two independent dimensions. Okay, depending on whether you are sending and receiving is persistent or not, and whether communication is synchronous or asynchronous, you will have different combinations. Okay. So the first one is persistent asynchronous. This is as I was telling you, it's basically email is a good example of that. This is what's happening. Okay. Here is the client, here is rather the sender, B is the receiver. And so the A is executing. At this point it has sent off a message and it continues to execute. Okay? Because asynchronous means it is not blocking. You have just done a send and you continue doing something. So at some later point the message arrives at the destination and you basically take delivery of the message and process it. Okay? And because this is persistent, okay, you will see that when the send takes place, B is not actually running. Okay? But the message will be held for you somewhere in the system until B starts executing. So here B starts and receives the message. Okay? So persistent means it's buffered. Asynchronous means you don't have to wait. You don't have to block. Okay? Here is persistent synchronous. Okay? So what happens here, synchronous just means that you are going to block. Okay? So here is A. It's sent off and it's blocked until it has the message has reached at the other end, and as the acknowledgement comes back saying message has reached its destination. Okay? And then you can continue executing. So A has blocked until message has reached the other end. Okay? But because it is persistent, you are not requiring that B be running when the message actually arrives here. Okay? So B can take delivery of that message at some later time. Okay? And then until that, the message is going to be buffered in the system. Okay, so the other combinations here are transient asynchronous and transient synchronous. So previous one we had persistent synchronous and asynchronous. Here we have transient synchronous and asynchronous. Okay. Transient basically means that both A and B have to be running because the message is not going to be buffered. Okay, if there's one of the endpoints is not running, message is discarded. So in all of these scenarios, both endpoints are actually running at the same time. And synchronous and asynchronous just tells you whether the sender is going to block or not. Right? So in transient asynchronous, both A and B are running. Okay? And since it's asynchronous, this is non-blocking send. So A basically executes, it does a send and it continues execution. The message actually goes over the network and B is assumed to be running. So B can immediately take delivery. Okay? B receives the message. Okay. This is transient asynchronous. That's example here is also UDP. Okay, that's how UDP actually works. Okay. And there are very three flavors of transient synchronous. Okay, there is a receipt base that's what's shown here, and the next slide shows two others. So in this case, again, because it's transient, A and B are both running, but this is blocking sends. Okay. So A is executing, it does a send and it blocks. Okay. And then B is also executing, but as soon as the message reaches here, then you get an acknowledgement. Okay. Depending on what the ACK tells you, you will have different flavors of transient synchronous. So this is called receipt-based transient synchronous. So all that the ACK is telling you is the message was received at the other end. Okay. Doesn't mean that the message has been delivered to the application. The OS at the other end has received your message. So it's reached the machine, okay, not to the application. That's called receipt-based. Okay. So there are two other forms of ACKs. One is delivery-based and one is response-based. Okay. So if the ACK actually tells you not only has the your message reached the machine, it has actually reached the application, meaning the application has taken delivery of your message. This is called delivery-based. Okay. Asynchronous RPCs that we looked at two classes back are an example of this. Because the ACK actually tells you that message has been delivered. Okay. The last one is response-based. The ACK actually gives you a response. Okay. So this is your standard RPC, synchronous blocking RPC. So you send a request, okay, the process is processed and you get a response, and you are blocked until the reply actually comes back to you. Not just blocked until the message receipt status has been told to you. You are blocking for a response.
What's the benefit of received by the delivered as opposed to received by the machine? Just the OS returns instantly.
Right. So the question is, what's the difference between receipt-based and delivery-based? Okay. In one case, you know that the message has reached the machine. In another case, you know that the message is being received by the application.
But okay. What is the difference? Why do you care?
Right. So the reason you may care is, let's say, take an example of email. Okay. In email, you don't get an acknowledgement, but consider the scenario where your mail actually reached the sender, and the sender actually read your mail. Okay. These are two differences. So if the mail doesn't bounce back to you, you assume that the mail actually made it to the other end. Okay. That doesn't tell you whether this person you sent mail has actually read your message. It only says that it is actually sitting in his inbox or her inbox. Okay. In the delivery base, you know that the client has actually taken delivery, means this person has actually started their mail client, taken delivery. Okay. So that's the distinction really. So there are several scenarios where you will care whether the application has taken delivery or not. Okay, just because it reached there doesn't mean the application has actually started processing it.
So you can assume it will eventually start processing it if it's reached the machine.
You can assume that. You don't know. That's all. So there may be a lag between when it reached here and when it actually got delivered to the application. The application may be doing other things. So it just gives you, so we'll see examples of how this is implemented. Okay. So depending on what you want the ACK to tell you from an application standpoint, you can use one or the other. It's a subtle distinction. Okay. In many cases, it may not matter. One may be as good as the other, as you're pointing out. But in some other cases, it may matter. Okay. Is this clear? Okay. So, the socket, so now we'll actually look at systems that implement all of these flavors. Okay. So, I already showed this slide last time. This is your socket-based client-server application. Okay. So, this is basically using the same message-oriented model. And which of these combinations is the socket example going to fall into?
We're talking TCP sockets?
Yes, standard TCP sockets. So first you have to ask, is it transient or persistent?
Transient.
It has to be transient, okay? Because both endpoints have to be running. Okay? And then is the sender doing blocking sends or a non-blocking sends? It's a blocking sends. Okay? So it's synchronous. So socket communication is transient synchronous communication by default. Okay. Because if the other, it's not persistent, because if the other endpoint is not running, you cannot send messages on a socket. For instance, TCP will just tear the connection down if the process is not running or has crashed. Okay. So it's transient, which means both endpoints have to run. And whenever you do a send on a socket, which was basically this part, or a read or a write, you do blocking reads or writes. Okay. So it is synchronous as a result.
And you get an immediate ACK when it reaches the machine.
Yes. TCP gets an ACK in socket, not the application doesn't actually get an ACK. Because
right.
TCP has an abstraction of a reliable channel, the application doesn't need to get any acknowledgement. Application is already guaranteed by TCP that anything you send is going to be received at the other end, so long as the other endpoint is alive. If the other endpoint crashes, there's no guarantee.
So it's almost persistent as long as it's alive.
Well, it's persistent means you can basically wait for arbitrary amounts of time. Could be hours, minutes, days, months, still be delivered next time the application runs. Okay. So as you will see, socket communication, although it's very flexible, gives you only one of these various combinations. It's transient synchronous communication. So now we'll see several examples that actually implement all of the others. Okay. So the first sort of example or case study is that of MPI or message passing interface. Okay. This is basically a layer that does something very similar to what socket communication does. It gives you a low-level communication interface for processes that are running on a cluster. Okay. These are specifically designed for parallel applications or scientific applications that run in parallel on large clusters. Okay. The most important issue here is efficient communication, because these are parallel applications, they communicate a lot. There are lots of processes, there may be lots of machines, and they communicate. Okay? Communication is often the bottleneck because it is slow, it goes over a network. So what MPI tries to do is it tries to make communication very efficient. Okay? But it does something more than that. I mean, sockets are just as efficient. But what sockets do is they give you only one abstraction, that, as I mentioned, transient synchronous communication. MPI does whatever socket does, but it gives you the full range. All of the combinations that I showed you are implemented in the MPI interface, as we'll see. So the things to keep in mind is basically it's a layer that allows you to write parallel applications and provides an efficient library for inter-process communication. But it gives you more richer set of abstraction than vanilla sockets do. And we'll see what all this. So here are the primitives that you have. So you will see that unlike in the socket case, there's only one send, basically the read or write, which is just blocking. Okay. Here you have a whole range of them. Okay, you have something called bsend, you have send, ssend, send receive. So what bsend does is it basically appends outgoing message to the local buffer. So all you do is when you do this bsend, it will just copy your message to the local OS and then the application can continue. Okay? So when the bsend calls returns, all you know is that your message has been delivered to the local OS. Okay? Not even the remote host. When you do send, you send a message and you will block until the message is copied to the remote buffer typically. So this tells you when this call returns, after you do this send it, it returns, you know that the message has actually reached the OS at the other end. Okay? First one just said the message has reached the local OS. This one says it reached the OS at the other end. And ssend says you wait until receipt starts, which means that not only did it reach the other end, the application at the other end has taken delivery. So it has read the read from this MPI socket. Okay. And the last one is send receive. You send a message and you wait for reply. This is almost like an RPC. Sent a message, it not only reached the other end, it was not only received, it was processed and a reply was sent back to you. Okay. So all of the examples I showed you of combinations of synchronicity and persistence are all implemented here. Okay. So same as socket interface, but it has sort of a much richer interface for doing sends and receive. You can pick the one that your application wants. You are not restricted to using transient synchronous as in the socket case. Okay?
What's the iSend?
Okay, so there are two other things which is called iSend. Okay, so here what you do is in the normal send case, whenever you do a send, you specify a buffer. Okay, there's a piece of memory in your application and the OS is actually going to copy that buffer into the kernel address space and then work with that copy. It's going to actually send that buffer. Okay? Now as I mentioned, what is important in parallel application is the overhead of communication. Okay? Message copying can be expensive, especially if you're sending and receiving large amounts of data. In scientific communication, you might have to send megabytes, gigabytes of data. Okay? Okay. So when you do send, you want sends to be as efficient as possible. Okay. So to do this, in addition to the traditional send, which involves data copying from user space to kernel space, you have what is called isend. So here you actually give a pointer to the kernel. The kernel is actually not going to make a copy. It's going to work with the application memory. Okay. And the assumption is the application, since it has explicitly passed a pointer, it will not override that pointer until some acknowledgement is received. Because if it overrides it before it has been sent out, the kernel is going to send a modified buffer, not the one that was handed to it by the isend call. Okay. So you have to take some precautions when you use this, but it is more efficient because it involves one less copy. Okay. So there is a isend and isend, which is you send a reference to the outgoing message and continue. Essentially you send, here is the buffer, take this contents and send them out, and you just tell the OS and you continue. Okay. And isend, you basically do this and you wait until receipt start, meaning you know that it has been copied and sent to the other end, the application has started receiving it at the other end. Okay. So this is just eliminating one copy, sometimes useful when you do, when you have performance bottlenecks. Yeah, there are two forms of receive. One is a blocking receive, another one is a non-blocking receive. If you do this receive, this is very similar to sockets. You will wait until something has arrived on your socket. Okay, it's a blocking receive. You do receive and there's nothing, no one has actually sent you anything, you will block until something comes over this socket. Okay. Same thing is true in MPI receive. Okay. And if you don't want to block, you can use iReceive, which is just polling. You just make a call. Okay. If there is data to be delivered, it will deliver it. If not, it will just return saying there is no data that is arrived on your socket. Okay, so this is a non-blocking receive. Okay, it won't block until something comes, unlike the previous scenario. Is this clear? Okay. So the thing to keep in mind is not necessarily to memorize all of these primitives, but to understand that what MPI is doing is it is actually giving more flexibility to application designers. Depending on what semantics you want from your communication channel, in this case it's the MPI layer, you can use the right primitive. You are not restricted, unlike in the socket case, to use just transient synchronous. Okay? Alright. So the only thing to keep in mind is all of these are still the flavors of transient. Okay, they are not persistent. If the other endpoint is not running, you will not necessarily buffer this data somewhere until the application starts up. Okay? If you want that functionality, you have to have persistent communication, which we are going to talk about next. Okay, these are all flavors of still the transient, as we had seen in the... So as you can see, these are all flavors of transient communication. Okay, the only thing you are getting here is whether you are synchronous, asynchronous, and whatnot. Okay. So now we'll talk about message-oriented persistent communication. Okay. So here, even if the other endpoint is not running, messages will be stored somewhere for you. Okay. Simplest application example you know of this is email, as I just said. Okay. Email comes to you, you don't have to be logged in, message is delivered, it's sitting in your inbox, some later point. You can go and take delivery of that message, okay, by using a mail client. Okay. Now, question is, what are the abstractions you have to provide to write any arbitrary application which has these semantics? Okay. So, there's a class of systems called message queuing systems that support persistent communication, okay, typically asynchronous persistent communication. So what you can do is you can send and continue execution, and the system will somehow buffer the message for you if the endpoint is not running.
Couldn't you do this on the application level with like sockets by just holding your own queue, and as long as the application is running, you just keep checking it, it's up, send it, otherwise keeping queue?
Yes. So question is, could you not do this at the application level by actually taking delivery of the message and storing it somewhere? Message queuing systems do essentially that. They're an application level middleware. Okay, then this is not a OS level concept. So you use vanilla socket for communication, but there's another process that will buffer the message for you. This is what happens in email as well, right? Data is coming to you. Email messages use TCP/IP, but your mail client server is going to take delivery and buffer it for you. That's an application software. The same is true here. The MQS system process will take delivery and buffer it for you. Okay. okay, then you go to it at some later time to get delivery. Right? But the, what is shown in this picture is that by using persistent communication, there's this persistent queue somewhere in the network. Okay? That's going to hold your messages, and you don't put any restrictions on when the sender is running, when the receiver is running, and when the send happens and the receive happens. So you could do a send and a receive, and both the sender and the receiver could be running. You could do a send when the receiver is passive, not running, and the message is queued up. Okay? And at some later time, the receiver starts running and it can take delivery, and at that point, the sender need not be running. Okay? And you may have a scenario where the sender has done a send, it's appended some message to the queue, and it stops running. The receiver is not running at this point. Okay? At some later point, it could start running and take delivery. So that's how you can relax the assumption of what when things are sent and received. So here are the basic primitives in any message queuing system. Okay. So you have put and get. Okay. Put basically allows you to append a message to a queue. Okay. So you say put, specify buffer and the name of a queue, and then your queuing layer, which is basically a piece of middleware that sits between the application and the OS, is going to take this message. It will route it through the network, and at some end point, it could be an intermediate point or it could be the destination host, there is a queuing queue. Okay? This is typically a pipe, right? Because if it's in memory and the machine crashes, then you cannot guarantee persistence. So if you want to do real persistence, those messages actually have to be stored in a pipe. Okay? But in this case, you're just showing an abstract queue. You're not showing where it is implemented. Okay? But typically, it has to be implemented using a persistent storage mechanism.
The persistent storage
could
still crash.
Yes, so it's not fault tolerance in the sense of if the machine file system gets corrupt, then data is lost. So it's not going to deal with that, but it is not going to rely on the transient nature of RAM. Okay, because messages can be queued for arbitrary amounts of time. You can get an email message and you may not check your email for 3 weeks. Machine can get rebooted in the time. So if your email messages are held in RAM, they are going to disappear, which is why you get email in your in a file. The inbox is basically a file. Notice. The same is true of this queuing layer. Okay? So that's get, rather put. Get allows you to take delivery of the message. So it's a blocking call. So you block until the specified queue is non-empty, and you take the first message from the queue and deliver it to the application. Okay. So this is a blocking version of taking delivery, and if you don't want to block, then you can do asynchronous polling. Okay. So you can poll the queue saying, is there a message? Okay. If the queue is empty, then you sleep for some time, and then at some later point you can poll again. Okay. So you can keep doing this, and when there is a message, then you can do a get. Okay. Rather than just waiting, doing a blocking call and just waiting for a message, it may take a long time for any message to come. So you have this poll message. Okay. And then there's a fourth call called notify. In this case, the client is not going to explicitly check. Okay. You just tell the message queuing layer saying, signal me if a message arrives. Notify me. Okay. So it's a job of the message queuing layer to send an appropriate notification when the message arrives. And notice that the receiver need not be running. Okay. So it has to hold this notify, and when the receiver starts running, then you notify it. So you install a handler that is called when a message is put into a specified queue, which basically is a notify handler. So these are the basic abstraction. You know, the specific calls vary from system to system. There's a whole range of message queuing systems. But this is the basic set of functionality that they all support underneath. Any questions on this? So here is the general architecture of a message queuing system. Okay. So you have a sender here. Okay. The sender has a receive queue and a send queue. So when it does a put, things go into the send queue, and then they are routed over a network. And this is where I said you have application level routing mechanisms. These are not network level IP routers. Okay. These are intermediate message queuing systems that take delivery of the message, route it to the next hop, and they do store and forward. Okay. So this message, so if the path for the message is going from this node to this node back to the application, the message actually goes from here to here, and it is held here until R2 contacts R1 for messages. Okay. And then R2 is going to store it under the application endpoint, the MQS at the application endpoint, takes delivery of the message and holds it for the application. Okay. So at each point, it may be stored for an arbitrary amount of time. There is no time limit on how long you hold a message. You just hold it until the next node becomes available. Okay. And each of these queues might be disk files. Okay. These are not memory buffers. You could actually hold the data on disk for arbitrary amounts of time. Okay. Is this clear? Okay. So what you have in the middle are called relays. Okay. They do something similar to what a router does. And you have what is called an overlay network. Okay. So this is not the physical topology of the network. It's just an overlay network where you have relays that are running on some nodes. And there may be actual IP routers that may be multiple hops between any of these two. Logically, this just looks like one hop, but physically there may be multiple hops in between. This is just one machine talking to another machine on the network. There may be an arbitrary number of network hops in between. Okay, but for the purpose of routing the message through an MQS system, this is looks like just a logical link. It went from R1 to R2, R2 to the application endpoint. Okay. Yes.
Why would you want relay? Wouldn't you just want to say from the start point to the endpoint?
Okay, so good question. So the question is, why do you want relays? Don't you? Can you not just have direct communication from this endpoint to that endpoint?
You go over routers, but you still get there eventually.
Yes, you could certainly do that. Okay, in fact, if you actually look at the architecture of how mail delivery has evolved, okay, in the olden days, you basically had these relays where each machine basically collected messages from a set of machines and then delivered it to the next endpoint and so on. And there were a number of hops that your message could transit through before it got to the endpoint. Okay. As network systems have gotten more stable, today mail delivery basically takes more, in most cases, your mail client sends it to your local mail server. The mail server tries to contact the server at the other end directly, okay, and just delivers it in one hop. Okay, and then it is held there until the client there takes delivery. Okay. But you don't need to instrument your mail architecture in this fashion. You could have a local mail server that takes all the mail for this department, for instance. Every mail client just sends to the local server. The local server could send it to the organization level server. So UMass could have a mail gateway and require that all local servers actually send mail to that gateway, and that gateway is going to take care of delivering it to the other end. So mail will flow through multiple hops, and that gateway can then deliver directly to the gateway at the other organization. And from there it can be delivered to the local mail server, and so on. Okay. So that's the reason. It just gives you more flexibility if you have this architecture. Okay. The other thing that I haven't mentioned is, if you actually have this architecture, you can also implement publish subscribe. You can figure out which messages are actually sent if there are subscribes and so on. So you can implement publish subscribe systems on top of message queuing systems. Okay. And we'll look at publish subscribe system later on in this course, the entire chapter that we'll come to later on. Any questions here on MQS? Okay, so here are here's one more entity that I didn't talk about. Most MQS systems will have what is called a broker program. Okay. A broker program can implement various functionality at the application level. It may reside in any intermediate hop. Okay. One thing it could do is prioritization. Okay. So if messages are coming in and they need to be sent to the next hop, it can decide whether certain messages get priority. Okay. All of this, what we are seeing here, just looks like a FIFO queue. Okay. That need not be the case. Messages could have priorities. They can jump over other messages and get precedence in the system. All this is determined by the broker program. It decides which queue to use, where to place it in the queue. It doesn't have to be FIFO. It could also do filtering for you. Okay. Certain messages may be discarded under certain scenarios. If the user is not interested in it, you may actually discard that message for you. Okay. So in your mail, if you have a spam filter, that's an example. Okay, it is actually not delivering every message that comes in. Certain message gets filtered out. Okay. An MQS broker can do some very similar things for you. Okay. It can, your application can tell the MQS saying these types of messages can be discarded immediately, I'm not interested in them, or file them away in this queue, I will separately from all my other messages. So you could do a variety of things using a broker. Okay. And we'll come back to all of this in the context of publish subscribe. Okay, this is where a lot of the intelligence is when you implement a publish subscribe system in the broker. Okay. So here's a quick case study of one particular system that implements message queue. Okay, this is IBM's WebSphere MQ. Okay. WebSphere is actually not one product really now. It has just become a term that's is a portfolio of products, and one of the many things that WebSphere portfolio gives you is a message queuing system. Okay. This is just a simple example of what the system looks like. It is actually a bit complicated. It has combination of RPCs, it has message queuing, it has routing, whole bunch of functionality implemented in it. So you will see that the sending and the receiving agents are stubs. Okay? So the sender and the receiver, although they are sending messages, they use RPCs to do the send. So your get and put are actually RPCs. Okay? And the RPC is not going to the endpoint, it is basically an RPC from the sending client to the local MQS system. Okay, so these two entities talk using an RPC. So this stub actually talks to the stub here. Okay, and once the message comes here, then your broker is going to decide which queue to send it on. Okay, and it can be routed through the system to an arbitrary number of hops. Each hop is going to implement your store and forward paradigm until it reaches the other end. And here also there is RPC. So your MQS at this end is going to use RPCs to send the message to the program stub, and the program stub can then deliver it to the receiving client. So it uses this combination of RPCs and MQS or message queuing to implement this system. Okay. There are these entities called message channel agent or MCAs that are shown here. Okay. So this provide various processing functionality. Okay. It checks the queue, it basically constructs TCP packets, it does the sends and whatnot. And then there are broker programs, which are not shown here, that will provide some of the functionality I showed you earlier. Okay. So if you write an application using MQS, you have to basically use their API, but that's what the architecture looks like. Any questions on this?
What's the MCA box doing in the receiving client?
What's them? It's basically...
It's outbound.
Okay, so basically because there's a sending and a receiving, these are multiple hops, there's a receiving MCA and a sending MCA. Okay, so here messages have arrived, this one is deciding which queues to put it in, and then this MCA is going to send it to a next hop. If there's a destination already, it gives you to the server stub, it gives it to the application. So this could act both as a router and an endpoint for delivery. Okay. Any questions? Okay, so since we still have a little bit of time, I'm going to talk about stream-oriented communication, and then we'll end there. Okay. So everything that discussed thus far falls into this category of message-oriented communication. So there's a message that is sent, the client-server architecture that is assumed, and if you can send a message, you can receive messages. There is this whole other paradigm of communication, which is called stream-oriented communication. Simplest example of this is audio and video streaming. Okay. The way communication takes place when you have an audio server and an audio client, or a video server and a video client, is very different from the request response client servers paradigm that we have seen thus far. Okay. So to understand this, we can take an example of, let's say, video. Okay. So you want to take a video file and you want to stream it over a network. Okay. There are some things you have to keep in mind. Okay. Video and audio data is isochronous, which means it has timeliness constraint. Once you start streaming data over a network and the client has started taking delivery, if you stop sending data, okay, and the client buffer empties, playback is going to stop. From a user perspective, jitter in the playback is not good from the user experience standpoint. If you start watching YouTube video, for example, and there is a lot of network overload and your video keeps freezing, this just doesn't give you good performance from your video player and the network. Okay, you just basically don't get a very satisfactory playback experience. So what this says is basically video has to be delivered, data has to be delivered before the playback deadline. each piece of data, each video image or each audio sample has a playback deadline at the client. Okay? And the network has to deliver this data to the client before its deadline, otherwise there is going to be problems with the playback. Okay? So that is one constraint that you have when you have isochronous communication. Okay? So in other words, what you have to do is provide some bound. The way you are going to deliver data before its deadline is if you have a bound on the end-to-end delay. So if you know that this takes so much time to get there, you need to initiate the send before the maximum delay, so you are guaranteed that data is going to get there. Typically, networks do not give you a bound on the end-to-end delay. The TCP/IP is not going to give you any guarantees on when data is going to be delivered. Okay? It can take arbitrary and variable amounts of time. Okay? But there are networks that were designed that will provide you guarantees on the end-to-end delay. Okay? They are not deployed commercially, but there has been a lot of work on how you can provide such guarantees. Okay? So this is one difference, that data, when you do a send, there is a deadline on by which it has to be received at the other. The other big difference is you don't use request response for communication, you use the server push mode for communication. Okay, I mentioned this when we were talking about client pull and server push. Okay. So in all of these cases, your client is going to say something like play to the server. Okay. Play this video file or stream this video file or audio file. From this point on, the client, the server is going to keep sending data to the client without any further request from the client. The client is not going to say, give me the next 10 seconds of video and not send any explicit request like this. It's going to just say play, and data is going to arrive over the network at the playout rate. If it's 100 kilobits per second stream, you are receiving data at approximately 100 kilobits per second. Okay. The server keeps sending data at this rate, it is received at the other end, and you keep playing it out. Okay. So there is no explicit request response communication that is taking place between the client and the server. Okay. This is why it is called stream oriented communication. You are streaming data over a network, okay, without explicit request for it. Yes.
What's the one thing between? You just take the cursor and put in the middle of the file, and then you want to continue from there. So isn't that a
yes. So question is, in typical video or audio playback, you can actually change the playback point. Okay? You can do things like even fast forward, rewind, pause. Okay? So user actions trigger a request. Okay? So if you do pause, that's a request that goes to the server saying stop. If you actually change the playback point by using this slider, that triggers a new request saying start playback from this new point. Okay? That's the same as pressing the initial button saying play. Okay? Any user action does trigger a request to the server, but once you send that, from that point on you don't send explicit request. That's the point being made. You basically initiate. Okay, initiate could be start from the beginning, start from this point. Those are all requests that involve explicit communication. But beyond this point, the server doesn't have to, or rather, the client does not have to do anything. Okay? That's basically what is being.
When we stop in the middle, so are these the requests into the server? Because even if you stop, the stream takes place. I think that's the pushing mode.
Right. So there's a question about when you do a stop, is the client actually, does it stop sending data? Or when you do a pause in particular, if you do a stop, actually data stops. When you do a pause, does the data keep flowing over the network? Mm-hmm. This is really depends on what protocol you are using between the client and the server. So what streaming protocol? There will be scenarios where when you do a pause, that streaming protocol actually sends a request to the server saying pause. Okay? There are other streaming protocols, so when you do a pause, the local video player just pauses the playback, but data continues to arrive. Okay? So this is basically an issue of streaming protocol. It's there are protocols that do either. Yes, so what has been implemented in many clients that are available now, when you do a pause, it basically just does a local pause, but data keeps coming. Okay. Any other questions on this? Okay. So here is an example of, two examples of stream-oriented communication. Okay. Here, what is shown here is what's called live streaming. Okay. Most of the streaming you might have seen where you actually go to YouTube and start playing back, it's called stored streaming. The data is actually on a file somewhere. Server is just streaming to you. Okay? But there is other mode of streaming called live streaming. This is when you do video chat or if you use Skype, right, where you are using your video camera, then you have what is called live streaming. Here the requirements for streaming are even more stringent because there is real-time communication between two parties. Okay? So what is shown here is a video camera that's capturing a video feed, sending it over a network, and someone at the other end is viewing. As I said, it could be Skype video conferencing or anything similar to this. Okay. Here, because there may be a camera at the other end that's doing the same thing in the reverse direction as well. Okay. If you have this interactive communication, then you have fairly stringent requirements on when data needs to be delivered. Okay. You cannot have large delays in when the data goes. So if you send this and it appears at the other end 5 seconds later, and you are using this for video conferencing, your audio is also going to arrive 5 seconds later. So there's going to be significant problems in real-time communication. I speak and then 5 seconds later it gets to the other end, and when that person speaks, so I have to speak and wait for 10 seconds of silence. It is not good from a communication, real-time communication perspective. You want data to get there in orders of hundreds of milliseconds for real-time communication. That imposes certain requirements on the network. The network is not provisioned to give you that level of performance, you are going to see problems. Okay, just as when you do Skype over a congested network, you see drops and you see freezes, that's the same problem. Okay, because in the internet does not provide you any guarantees. If the network works well, things work, otherwise they don't. Okay. But that said, the application still has this requirement. The question is whether the network is able to satisfy it or not. Okay. That's one mode of communication. It's also one-to-one communication. You could also have things like webcasts, okay, where there's a single source that is transmitting and there are multiple receivers. Okay. So this could be a live event that you are tapped into. Okay. There's a live streaming over the internet. You're watching, let's say, a sports game, and there's a live streaming of this game. And you have one sender. Okay. And there are lots of receivers that are all listening on to this live stream all at the same time. So what you have is a distribution tree. Okay. This is referred to as a multicast tree that has gotten constructed. The data actually basically flows down this tree. So from here it goes to the root of the tree. The root of the tree sends it to the next two nodes and so on and so forth until it trickles to the leaves. The leaves are all of the receivers in your system. Okay. This is one-to-many communication. Also called multicast communication. The most simple sort of popular example of where you use this is live webcast, where there are multiple receivers and a single sender. Okay. So these are two examples. Yes, I will stop here. There's some material on quality of service, but let me come back to that next time. Okay. So we'll just stop here. Don't go yet. I have the homework that has been graded. I want to hand that out.